Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. All right. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm really excited to have two of our pharmacists from the Farm to Table team here with me today. So we have Dr. Katie Johnstone, and she is in Maine. And then on the other side of the country, also sort of in a rural area, we have Dr. Sarah Botchnoffer, and she is in her cabin in Montana joining us today. So thank you both for being here. I'm really excited for this topic because we talk a lot about gut health. We talk a lot about stress, and then we don't really, like, even in the sort of modern blogosphere type environment, social media, there's not a lot of discussion about this topic of cognitive decline that we're going to talk about tonight. Certainly from a broader standpoint, there's media talking about Alzheimer's and all of the increase in Alzheimer's, and there's data going into this, but not as much conversation, I think, in our sort of space with patients that talks about how we can actually prevent this from a nutritional standpoint or address this from a nutritional standpoint. So thanks again for joining me today. And I'm just going to get us started with some statistics on Alzheimer's. And so Alzheimer's disease now has about 1 in 9 Americans that are over 65, 5.2 million people as of 2017 that have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So I know for many of us, this topic is really personal. Actually, Katie here and myself both had grandparents that have or had Alzheimer's disease. And so, you know, this is something that's close to our families and many of you, because 1 in 9 people, we know someone that has Alzheimer's disease almost as closely as we know people that have diabetes. So the number one concern with these patients is, as we age, the loss of cognitive abilities. So memory loss, not remembering those we love. My grandmother died of Alzheimer's disease when I was in 7th grade, and I can still see clear as day, like, her laying in that bed, just completely helpless and not able to do anything for herself anymore, almost reversed back to being a child or a baby again. And so this just complete reversing of our cognitive function. And then not only is this affecting millions and millions of lives, but this is a huge cost to our healthcare system. So the annual cost for dementia alone is $215 billion per year, which is more than cancer and heart disease. So while it's seemingly a really grim situation, and very few conventional doctors, there's very few toolkit things for those patients. There's really the medications. There's actually about 4 medications that are available for Alzheimer's, and sometimes they can lessen the quickness of the decline or lessen some of the symptoms, but typically only for a really short period. And we don't really have treatment to keep those mild to moderate patients going to full-blown Alzheimer's. And so the Alzheimer's Association actually says a genuinely new Alzheimer's drug has not been approved since 2003, and the currently approved medications are really ineffective at stopping or slowing the course of disease. And while many people think Alzheimer's is genetic, it's actually sort of the accumulation of amyloid plaques, or the loss of acetylcholine in the brain, which can be a component of some genetic pieces. So if people have ApoE genes, ApoE4 specifically genes, and others that can contribute to that. But there's also, you know, some other things that we're going to talk about that can contribute to improving neuroplasticity in the brain or neurosignaling in the brain. So it's not just genetic. So there's the genetic piece, but there's also other things. And so it really happens when the brain is trying to protect itself from inflammation, which we talk about a lot on this podcast, decline and shortage of nutrients or hormones or other brain supporting molecules, and really toxic substances. So sometimes there's heavy metals or biotoxins like mold, and that can affect our cognitive function. I've been seeing more and more patients present with mold lately, and so many of them, brain fog is an early symptom of that. So if we think about people that are exposed over a lifetime, what that can do to their cognitive function. So over that lifetime of being exposed to so many toxins and having the salts on the brain, it really has this stress or the oxidative stress that is a major contributor to dementia. So we're going to talk about that. And insulin resistance is a huge piece of this. You know, if people have advanced cognitive decline, there may be this point where we can't help them with the drugs that are available. But when we dig a little bit deeper into the functional medicine and the imbalances occurring in the metabolism and take sort of a different look at the lifestyle pieces, there's a lot that we can do to prevent cognitive issues from developing in the first place. And so that's really what our focus is tonight. Not that there's absolutely nothing you can do in those severe cases. And there are some amazing integrative and functional medicine providers that specialize in this. But tonight we're really going to talk about the prevention aspect. So anything else you guys want to add to that portion?
Just into, as pharmacists, we, you know, may not have the drugs available, but we also can point out things like the drug-induced nutrients that are depleted from some medications, like B12, which is a like major contributor to memory loss and dementia. And they also deplete things like zinc and magnesium, which we'll touch on later, that are really important too for brain health.
Yeah. Yeah. And the gut and nutrition piece we're going to talk about too, there's such a direct correlation between what happens in the gut and the intestinal permeability piece in the gut, or sometimes we refer that as leaky gut, which we've talked about on the podcast before. And we can actually get this leaky brain presentation as well when our blood-brain barrier is also permeable and allows things to go into the brain tissue that really shouldn't be there. And that's a big deal and part of the reason for a lot of this to happen. So talking a little bit about insulin resistance. So Alzheimer's is starting to be called, in a lot of the research studies, type 3 diabetes. And the reason for this is Dr. Dale Bredesen has a lot of information in this sphere, and this is really his big area of influence. But insulin resistance is arguably the most important contributor to Alzheimer's disease. And your brain uses a lot of energy. It loves glucose since it's a quick energy source. And so when the brain cells become resistant to insulin, they actually shrink and die off. And then the human body is not designed to process more than about 15 grams of sugar a day. And that's more like added sugars, not necessarily carbohydrates, but the normal amount of sugar in our diet is astronomically more than that from the standard American diet. We also have sodas that have 50 to 75 grams of sugar in them, but some people can eat upwards of 200 or more grams of sugar a day. So those chronically elevated insulin levels really can wreak havoc on our brain and really set the stage for this widespread neuronal dysfunction that really can then cause issues for decades. So your body degrades insulin with an enzyme called insulin degrading enzyme, but insulin degrading enzyme also degrades amyloid and beta, these amyloid beta plaque, and causes this amyloid to accumulate. So over time, that really causes damage again to the brain cells. So early signs of insulin resistance that you should be thinking about are the waist to hip ratio, blood pressure elevations, if your healthy cholesterol, or I mean, there's some debate on if all high HDL is healthy, but if your HDL starts to drop and then LDL starts to go up. So if you start to see this metabolic syndrome picture, we also test in a lot of our patients a fasting insulin level. Other signs of insulin resistance are acanthosis nigricans, which is a darkening of the skin in the neck area. Skin tags can be signs of insulin resistance. And really just, I mean, you can check your insulin levels. Like I said, you can also do fasting glucose levels, and our morning fasting glucose levels should really be less than about 90, or ideally even 80, in the 85 to 70 range. So those are some things. There's a lot of factors that go into what your glucose level is, from your stress hormones to your sex hormones to your diet, this insulin level, all of these things, but these are all playing a role in your brain function. And so that reducing your intake of sugar, but also not just that, because you can still be an insulin resistant person and remove sugar if we don't fix sort of the other pieces of the puzzle. So it's going to be a combination of lifestyle factors. So Sarah's going to talk to us a little bit about the energy metabolism piece.
Yeah. So we're going to head right back into science class of 11th grade and go into the mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. So the mitochondria, they're built to convert calories and oxygen into ATP, which you might remember that phrase, but energy. But they produce the free radicals as a byproduct, which then cause oxidative stress. And that's sometimes a buzzword that you might have heard, but it leads to damage and inflammation in the body, also known as rapid aging. So you can think of it as essentially rusting of your body. So when we eat the nutritious foods that are full of antioxidants, and then those go and they seek out these free radicals and they clean them up before the damage can actually happen, before the rust can happen of your body. So one problem that occurs in Alzheimer's and many other diseases that are involving our cognition or thinking is that these symptoms require certain nutrients to function. And if we're deficient or low in these nutrients, this limits our ability to have these antioxidants come in and take care of these free radicals so that those enzymes can actually function. So the top nutrients that will support our mitochondria are acetyl L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, CoQ10, NADH, D-ribose, magnesium, B vitamins, and N-acetylcysteine. And you can reach out to any one of us to learn more about any of those nutrients, because there's a lot going on in that sentence there.
Yeah, we can link some of them on the show notes too in the protocol. Yeah.
Yep. So all of those, they come together and they work as a team. And it's why it's important to focus on food first, because our food kind of uses nutrients as a team anyways. And then you can use it that way. And we want to make sure that we have all of them on board. So it's important to get your nutrient levels checked so that you can actually personalize this to you, because you can go ahead and take that handful of supplements that I just said, but it isn't necessarily the ones that you particularly need, because you might be low in one but high in another. So that's where getting some testing comes really in handy. So there's some specific foods that you can eat that will support your brain and provide you with the nutrients for better cognition and healthy aging. And Katie is going to talk about that.
Yay, food for health. So since that oxidative stress is such a major contributor to inflammation, the best way to get in your body's natural ability to get rid of the free radicals is to eat the rainbow, which we've talked about before. So getting all those colorful plant pigments is going to help that situation. So the dark and colorful foods, so especially those green leafies, the green leafy vegetables. One study that we found that people who eat a cup of green leafy veggies have brains that act 11 years younger than those who don't, which I found fascinating. Also beets. So beets are cool. They help release nitric oxide. So they're good for vascular health in general. So that helps boost the blood supply to the brain. And then again, those dark colors. So berries like blueberries and blackberries, strawberries, cherries. These are really good low glycemic fruits. So they're low in sugar and loaded with antioxidants and phytonutrients. Teas. So green tea plant pigments are helpful for protecting the brain's cells as well. And another important category of foods, those healthy fats. So the low fat diets, I think, can be one of the worst diets for your brain, because your brain is made up of mostly fat and it's required for proper communication between your cells, your brain cells. So foods like olive oil, nuts, wild seafood, avocado. I love to cook with avocado oil. You know, those omega-3s too, the omega-3 fats. So these are essential for your brain function. The cell membranes of those mitochondria are made up of fatty acids. So you can think of your cell membrane as kind of the ears of your cells. And 60% of the brain is made up of DHA. So you may have heard of DHA from EPA and DHA that are in omega-3 supplements. So these can repair and rebuild those membranes and improve the communication in your whole body. Another important thing to think about too with the omegas is the ratio of the more inflammatory omegas. So those are the omega-6s. And so it's omega-6 to omega-3. Which has increased over time from about 1 to 1 in previous generations to now 10 to 1. And so this comes from those really highly processed seed oils like corn and soy and safflower. So they have a lot of oleic acid, which promotes inflammation and disease. And so if you're looking for omega-3s in the diet, you really want to look towards the wild fish, nuts and seeds like flax seeds. Again, it's, you know, unless you're eating salmon and all these things every day, it's tough to get enough omega-3s. So supplementation is usually recommended. We also can do testing, you know, that can see the profile of the different ratios of omegas that you have and even some inflammatory things like HSCRP.
Yeah. And I think I've been testing omega-3s on patients for the last like 6 or 7 years. And I will say there's been like 2 times that omega-3s have been normal on someone's profile. And both of those times they were already supplementing with omega-3s as part of their diet. So it just tells you like our diet is so, we have so much of that excess omega-6 fatty acids. And then we have so little of omega-3s in the standard American diet that it really needs to be something that we focus on as a sort of core supplement.
Yeah. For sure. Another thing that I think people don't realize when you think of like a plant to eat are spices and herbs. Mm-hmm. So one of the main reasons I hear of people who don't want to eat vegetables is that they don't taste good. And so I think using the seasonings and the herbs, like those Italian herbs and turmeric and pepper, they make things taste really good and make the vegetables taste really good. And they also have great antioxidants and help lower inflammation. It's also a big part of like the Mediterranean style diet. Mm. I think they use a lot more spices than we do here.
I actually had a patient stay in the office that was asking, she's going to Greece and she's like, what should I eat there? What should I avoid? I was like, you need to eat everything.
Everything and take notes.
Right. Exactly. I mean, maybe a little bit of like decrease the bread, but this particular patient, she's blood sugars are really well controlled. And I was like, well, I think you can even enjoy the bread if you're going away for 7 days and going to Greece. But yeah, she's like, well, I love olives and I love, you know, olive oil. And I was like, well, you just soak it up. And if you have to use bread to soak it up, you do it.
Yep. Yep. It's definitely, well, yeah, olives are another one that's a healthy fat. Mm-hmm. And one thing that is definitely not short in the standard American diet is coffee.
Yeah.
So in depending on the quality that you get, but in moderation, again, things in moderation are good for your brain and help slow, maybe even moderate cognitive decline. I mean, I think we all personally have experienced the wonderful effects of cognitive abilities with coffee. So, you know, 1 to 2 cups is usually good. Probably limit even that if you're like a really slow metabolizer and you get the jitters from coffee. Again, the quality matters with this because coffee is one of the biggest sources of like pesticides and mold.
Yes.
You want to make sure you're getting an organic.
Yes. I think that's my biggest challenge because I will make it at home and it's great. But then like you want that cup of coffee out somewhere and you don't know, like, you know, the testing and certainly chain places that we all love. I don't think they test or do any kind of quality control on that. So the moral of the story is invite people over for coffee instead.
And it's good. It's better. So yeah, what else in the diet? So amino acids, which those are our building blocks for neurotransmitters. So when you think of neurotransmitters, think mood, thoughts, and memory. Again, these are things that are created in the gut and, you know, they're important, obviously functioning in the brain, but we want to make sure we're getting enough in the diet. So this is why those good proteins are important. And when you think protein, obviously, unless you're a vegetarian, but you want to think animals in their natural environment. So grass-fed, organic beef and poultry, pasture-raised eggs are a great source of those B vitamins and choline to support the acetylcholine. Another big thing to support the gut, those high fiber fermented foods, we want to feed the right bacteria, aka the probiotics, with the right bacteria food or the prebiotics. So that is going to increase our diversity and lower inflammation in the gut. So those prebiotic foods are like artichoke, mushrooms, leeks, and the green bananas. I don't know how many people are going to just like munch on green bananas, but sometimes it's good to just slice them up and put them in a smoothie to get that in. And then probiotic foods are all our fermented things like sauerkraut, pickles, kimchi, that low sugar kombucha, tempeh, miso, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think too, along with those amino acids, I find that most Americans don't get enough protein in their diet. When I'm talking to them, they're talking about removing all these carbohydrates and protein. I mean, I think you should work with a nutritionist, dietitian to really figure out, especially if you're an athlete or you are having a certain health condition, how much protein you can have. Some health conditions, you do have to decrease protein if you have kidney failure and things like that. But for the average person, there's some different protein calculators out there online. A lot of times it's your minimum level of protein is really like your weight in kilograms times like 0.8 grams is really the minimum. But then you have to add in all of those considerations for your activity level and your exercise. Really, protein is such a huge piece, and so much of longevity conversations are really about muscle building and really keeping those muscles from atrophying. And so in that case, we need protein to do that. And so amino acids are a huge piece. I don't think we talk about that enough in the aging process. All right. So we talked a lot here about this Mediterranean style diet. So we all wish we were going on this trip with my patient to Greece this week, but I'm excited to hear about it. But the really hallmarks, again, just to review what Katie just said, like lots of vegetables, lots of those healthy oils, trying as best you can to make sure your source of the oil is good. I know there's a lot of conversations about olive oil being tainted and avocado oil being tainted with these canola or rapeseed type oils. So we have to do our best and our due diligence. Certainly California grown olive oil is generally more pure than some of the imported olive oil. So I know that's sad because you think that we're getting the best thing from other places, but sometimes that's not the case. Keep an eye on those things. And then really there's some other conversations that are had in this cognitive decline space, particularly related to that insulin resistance, is doing a keto type diet, but doing like a mild ketogenic plant-based diet. And this is from Dr. Bredesen's work. He calls it the Keto Flex, but basically helps improve your metabolic flexibility, going from using this glucose only fuel to turning it into the ketogenic source and using fats for fuel. And so it's an intermittent fasting. You're going to fast for at least 12 hours, 3 hours before bed. So not eating the bowl of ice cream before bed, guilty habit sometimes over here, and not having snacks before bed. I hear that from patients a lot. Oh, I need to eat this from before bed. And some of that comes from them taking improper medications that cause them to have low blood sugars if they don't take a snack before bed. So even that comes back to working with maybe a pharmacist involved in your care team to figure out, okay, like today I had a patient that came from a national facility where he's getting medications, where the national facility has the drugs that are appropriate on formulary, but he was getting a medication that caused hypoglycemia. So in the middle of the night, he's dropping to 50. And that also stimulates some of these reactive oxygen species and inflammation related to all of this. So I say that to say not everyone can do this fasting if you're on some of those medications. So you definitely want to make sure that if your medications are going to be an issue and you're starting to fast, that you have that discussion with your healthcare provider. The intermittent fasting actually promotes these brain cells from growing instead of shrinking. And so this allows the cells in the brain and other parts of the body to recycle, remove damaged proteins, and the mitochondria to have this new energy source. Sometimes avoiding things like gluten or dairy or other foods, food sensitivities, there can be a lot of different types of food sensitivities, not just those. And they can develop from this intestinal permeability and this inflammation going on in the gut. So if there are things that are causing inflammation, those being pulled out of the diet might need to happen in order to help the inflammation. Generally, we try to pull them out and then heal the gut and then try to work them back in if we can, because there's certainly some good health benefits even from some of those foods. But making foods with low glycemic index part of your diet, so that means they're not spiking your blood sugar super fast. And so you can find all kinds of articles. We'll try to link some for you in the show notes about what is glycemic index, what foods are low glycemic index. We talked about the berries and different nutrients there, but lots of detoxifying plants in the body, like this cruciferous in your diet, the cruciferous vegetables, garlic, ginger, lemons, grapefruit can be really important. Now, grapefruit, you have to watch out. So the pharmacists here are going to remind you that if you're on certain statin medications or certain blood pressure medications, you might not be able to consume grapefruit. But again, another question and reason to have a pharmacist as part of your holistic care team. So Sarah's going to talk to us about some of the vitamins and nutrients for cognition and which ones are sort of her go-to for her patients.
I'm just so happy that we're talking about this topic. Like you said, it hits home for so many of us because we have grandparents that went through this. I myself, I have a grandparent on my father's side and my mother's side. So it's really on the forefront of my brain a lot, especially when I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't remember that person's name or right. What did I go to this room for? Like, I'm developing Alzheimer's, I'm sure of it. But, you know, we all have it in our close sphere of people that we know. And it really is something that I'm glad that we are addressing tonight. So as far as the vitamins and nutrients go, B vitamins are really easy go-to because a lot of us are low in B vitamins in general anyways. And one of the more important ones for our brain is vitamin B12. And it really tends to be low in the elderly. In fact, I worked at a nursing home and did the consulting for them. And that was B12 and folic acid were two things that were on every single blood panel that we ran on them when they first were admitted, just to make sure we didn't need to start supplementing there. And people just don't eat enough meat. And if you're on a proton pump inhibitor like omeprazole, that can actually make it so that you aren't able to make your B vitamins. And if you're supplementing with a B complex, if you're going to go toward that and try the supplementation form, make sure that the B12 is in methylcobalamin instead of cyanocobalamin, which is not absorbed very well, but it's cheaper to produce. So that's the one that you'll more commonly come across. Another B vitamin for the brain is thiamine or vitamin B1, and that's really critical for your memory formation. And then the next one that I think of, and Dr. Bredesen talks about the zinc copper ratio a lot, is zinc. And we often have too much copper and too little zinc, and that is really associated with dementia or memory loss. Zinc is critical for insulin to work properly, and it's actually critical for our stomach acid and digestion and all sorts of things. Low levels can increase autoantibodies, which is a source of inflammation, and it can enhance sensitivity to toxins, which is pretty big in Alzheimer's as well. All of those kind of go hand in hand with Alzheimer's development. Magnesium, pretty much everybody is low in magnesium, and it is so critical for brain function, especially for the parts of the brain responsible for memory consolidation. So that's taking something that happened that day and making it actually go and like stay there so that you can access that later. So vitamin D is another one. And again, especially I'm in Montana and we're all low in vitamin D. Many, many states are low in vitamin D. There's just not enough sun. And we're all so indoors these days that we just have the exposure even during the days that we have sun out. And low vitamin D, it is actually pretty well linked to dementia and also depression and so many, many other things. So vitamin D, I like this. It's like a Wi-Fi signal traveling through your blood into your cells, and it turns on up to 900 genes. And some of those are really crucial for your brain connections. When it's low, these genes, they just don't get turned on. So it's hard enough to get vitamin D in the diet unless you really like anchovies. Again, when we're in the northern climates, you're especially deficient, especially in the winter. And that's a piece of that more depression in the seasonal times. But spending time outdoors is helpful, but really like some of us in certain states are not going to be able to do that. We're aiming for levels between 50 and 80 nanograms per milliliter. And a good way to figure out how much to supplement is to take your current level, which therefore you need it to be tested so that you can know exactly where you're at, so that you know where you're trying to get to. And so your current level is 20, and you subtract your goal, maybe 50, and then multiply the difference by 100, and then that'll get your dose in international units, which is 3,000. The labeling of vitamin D these days is changing a little bit, so make sure to reach out to your pharmacist if you have some confusion in that, and what used to be international units is now milligrams or micrograms, and it's all over the place. So definitely let us know in the pharmacy or wherever you're at if you have any questions on that. So there's some other studies that show that high levels of vitamin E and C in the diet were very powerful and can lower your Alzheimer's risk by up to 70%. So making sure those are antioxidants and they're very powerful, really important nutrients to have. And people who eat diets high in vitamin C and E are eating mostly plant-based, nutrient-dense foods. The combination is key versus looking at the single nutrients. Again, like I said, nature has it figured out. Everything's in combination. It's not just like taking a bottle off of the counter. It really is working with everything together.
Yeah. And there's certainly, like, we could go into probably a whole nother study about this, but different types of vitamin E itself, that there's alpha, beta, gamma, delta, tocopherols, but they, and tocotrienols. So different ones have different roles. And a lot of times when the studies do like a study on high dose, whatever, it's like one specific type instead of that synergistic, all these different types. Or even if you think about the vitamin D studies where they're like, hey, vitamin D causes a U curve and you have cardiovascular mortality when you get this higher level of vitamin D. Okay, wait, they didn't study that in combination with K2. So what happens if we add K2 to that? Certainly, I think we probably don't want to push D levels much higher than 80. For the risk of calcifying arteries, but we definitely don't know, like, if we push it higher than that in a big, huge study with K2 on board, like what the outcome would be, and would it be different than when they did that with just the vitamin D? So nutrient synergy, we should probably do a separate podcast on that too, like talking about all those individual things where they're just piecing out one specific nutrient, because the whole vitamin E situation is really interesting too, especially in this cognitive decline conversation or cognitive function conversation. I would agree with the vitamin D piece as far as in Ohio here. I just same thing as the omegas. Like, I've almost never tested somebody for their vitamin D level, which is super easy to test. You can basically go and get your vitamin D level tested yourself at a lab and pay $30 sometimes to do it. But if, you know, your provider's ordering labs anyways, it's oftentimes covered on insurance if it's coded correctly. And in the case of the world that we live in, most people are vitamin D deficient, so they can use that ICD-10 code. But in Ohio, we also all are vitamin D deficient. I mean, we spend half the time indoors, even though I would say our just society in general spends so much time indoors more. Even if you are in the South, you're not working outside on the farm or in the field. You're probably working an indoor job under fluorescent lights. And so there's not as much of that. I mean, certainly they probably get more from the sun, but we were sunblocked when we're outside in periods of time that's actually blocking that conversion. So there's a lot of other factors going on in our vitamin D. So in general, I think COVID was a really good example of the nutrient depletion situation in the United States, not only D, but zinc and other nutrients. So certainly important. And like the ladies have mentioned, we have lots of different tests that we can look at your nutrient status. Some are as simple as blood draws at local labs, and others we might want to dig deeper into cellular level type things, or look at even the whole picture of like your Krebs cycle and your energy cycle. And do we need more of a certain nutrient to drive that energy cycle? Or are there certain toxins, which we haven't talked a lot about today, but are there certain toxins like mercury or lead or something that are blocking these nutrients from being used by your cells? And so that's a whole nother conversation about how we help the body get rid of those. To close, we're just going to talk about some of the other modifiable lifestyle factors, and exercise is huge. So I spoke a little bit about this before about building muscle. And so we also know that exercise improves blood flow to the brain and really acts as almost like a fertilizer for your brain. So the more you exercise, it's almost like strength training for your brain, but implementing strength training to avoid that developing frail is really important. So it helps just your posture to stay better. If you have stronger muscles, as you see people sort of go bent over time as they age, part of that is due to not having the proper muscle tone to be able to hold their body in the right place. And certainly osteoporosis and other things that are related to a lot of the same things that we're talking about. I was talking actually to a patient about this as well this morning about muscle building, and she was in her 70s and she goes to Silver Sneakers, and they do have some programs that actually help them do weight training and squats and things like that. And certainly there's issues sometimes people have with past injuries or, and that's really where working with a physical therapist that specializes in that type of injury or recovering from that type of energy, or even what exercises can I do that don't aggravate that energy and injury, excuse me, can be really important. And making sure you have approval from a cardiac standpoint from your doctor is important as well. But if you can, exercise is really a key here. So many of the people that I talk to that are in 90, over 100 or in their late 80s that are, I'm looking at them like, man, I want to be you when I'm 80, right? They're sitting in front of you. They have no cognitive decline. They're joking with you. And most of the time they're talking about going on a run afterwards, or they're talking about going for a walk, or that they go play golf with their friends. And the community aspect of that is important too. So some type of activity, maybe they swim or do different things, but so I can't stress enough how important movement is and trying to avoid sitting for long periods of time. I know it's almost impossible sometimes when you're working a job that requires you to be at a computer, but standing desk, I'm currently using a standing desk in my husband's office right now. So that's a big thing for him to help him stay. He works on the web and builds websites and programs stuff. So he needs to have that. So if that's you, consider those types of tools too. But another thing we could probably go on for hours about, which we've probably talked about on the podcast before, is sleep. And sleep is really when your brain sort of takes the trash out, and it's called the lymphatic system. And so it's really the time where your brain collects all the information from the day and consolidates that into memory formation. And so the things that we talked about before that are related to Alzheimer's disease, like the amyloid beta, they're actually more rapidly removed from the brain when an animal is sleeping versus when it is awake. And so that's been studied. And one of the most common complaints of people with sleep problems and a risk for cognitive decline is this middle of the night awakening, which potentially could come from hormone imbalances of cortisol. Sometimes it's other hormones. So our postmenopausal women, I truly believe that part of like why bioidentical hormone replacement helps cognition is related to this sleep component. And so I think there's a lot of other factors in how estrogen and the receptors, how estrogen affects the brain receptors and the progesterone. But I do think part of it is just helping people sleep, because I see so many postmenopausal women that come to the clinic and they're, you know, not sleeping. They're just can't shut their brains off. They have this more anxiety at night, or just have this excess cortisol production. So balancing hormones is big. So if you are that person, definitely work with a functional medicine or integrative medicine provider if you're interested in pursuing some hormones to help you with that. But another thing that was interesting with sleep is that there was an analysis of data that was done and published in 2021 that said that people in their 50s and 60s that got less than 6 hours of sleep were a greater risk for developing dementia compared to those that got normal amount of sleep, which they defined as at least 7 hours. The people with that got less sleep were 30% more likely to be diagnosed with dementia. So that's like crazy right there. If you think about one intervention that is going to help so much, is that sleep piece and making sure that you're getting the adequate rest. So again, we could go on about sleeping a lot, but burning the candle at both ends is not helping your body now, but it's definitely not helping your future self. And so definitely think about that before you keep burning that candle. And then addressing the stress in our life. We've talked a lot about stress. I think every podcast we talk about stress, we've done a whole summit on the solution to stress, and we can't eliminate it from our life, but learning how we react to control it. I will say I had a pretty stressful week last week, and some of it was sort of unavoidable. A lot of it was unavoidable. And my response, I could feel my heart rate getting fast. I could feel like the effects of stress on me, the tension in my shoulders. But what I went to do is I got a cup of tea that was calming chamomile type tea. I knew where my supplement was that had some nice melatonin blend and some L-serine and some other calming nutrients that I could take before bed. We got a hot tub this summer. So if you follow me on Instagram, you've seen that. That's like my favorite purchase of 22. And so like did all of that, sat in there, did some deep breathing exercises. So I know that in every situation, we can't do all of those things, but knowing what tools you have, even if it's the deep breathing exercises alone, taking a moment, stepping away from the situation, doing the deep breathing, maybe it's diffusing essential oils in your workspace if you're allowed, maybe it's just a cup of tea that you can grab while you're working, but something, I mean, there's certainly a lot of supplements that address stress. We talk about ashwagandha, we talk about gola and skullcap and so many others. Again, we could probably target another podcast for if we're going through all the adrenal supplements and how they work. But I think it's also individualized because certain people do better with one versus another. And sometimes if you're sort of in a burnout phase, you need some actual glandular support too. But anyway, so lots of ways that we can do stress. I mean, restorative yoga poses, yoga in general has lots of data. And I think even in this cognition space, lots of data because it helps your lymphatic systems. Again, that brain sort of cleaning things out and helps have more of that restorative deep sleep, which is super important. And then just to close, we really recognize that everyone has a unique genetic code. They're individual. They have unique nutritional and biochemical needs. And so this is really where testing can be of help. And so maybe it's doing nutrigenomics testing and figuring out what does your DNA look like? What kinds of nutrients should you be eating or might you be more likely to be deficient in? Maybe it's looking at what your actual nutrition deficiencies are. Maybe it's a combination of both. Maybe it's looking at the gut and figuring out, do you have this intestinal permeability? If you do, maybe it's likely that you have some of these other cognitive symptoms or more prone to those. But either way, we want to make sure that we're looking at your specific situation as functional medicine providers and looking at oxidative stress in your body. I definitely have seen patients before that there's certain websites and catalogs and different things, and then they take this and this and this and this and this, and all of a sudden we're taking 50 supplements and we're not actually doing this with nutrition anymore. We're just trying to live the standard American diet and throwing down the 50 supplements along with it. And while a lot of those have great data, you know, we haven't studied a lot of these things in combination. And so over time, you know, I just think we're going to learn more and more about this. And it's almost like we call using too many drugs polypharmacy. So we have this like whole poly supplement issue in the industry too. So definitely working with a provider that recognizes, like I had another person today that was on a lot of supplements and I was like, okay, like what can we pull back on? If you tried this, did it make you feel better? Did you notice a difference? Like if it didn't, and we didn't have a lab that we were looking at and we didn't feel better, like it's probably something that we can pull off and maybe reevaluate the need for that. And again, money is, for most people, not just like we have all of it and we can do whatever we want. So a lot of people do appreciate when providers can have that conversation and say, hey, I don't think you actually need that. Or I don't think that's serving you well right this second. Like let's focus on this area. So definitely consider that when you're making choices about all these things. So I think as more we can throw out there, oh, this is good for you. This is good for you. This is good for you. People get a little overwhelmed and all of a sudden they're the supplement store at their house. So any other thoughts on that, guys? Have you experienced that with your patients?
I mean, I experience it with myself. I have way too many. You hear something good about a supplement and it's like, oh, I'm going to go buy that now.
Right.
And then, you know, I try to take like a supplement holiday where I'll just take a few days off of everything, even the omega and the vitamin D, like just give my body a break, let it reset. And again, like coming back to just dementia and Alzheimer's, I think it's one of the biggest fears for people. Like they don't want to lose their memory and forget like people that they love. And mm-hmm. I think if more people understood the impact of metabolic health and insulin resistance and the diabetic feature and how much that is influencing it, we could really like shift and change the way that, you know, and help people live different lives. Because I think having that in the forefront, like if I can actually help prevent it with things that I can control, because that's another thing is I think it's misunderstood that it's only genetic, like you're just doomed mm-hmm. and they're just going to get it no matter what. And so I think if we can empower people and help them.
Yeah. And cool. I think there's also a lot of research where we didn't have time to dive in tonight too, of like infectious disease and links to Alzheimer's and some of the inflammation and some of these maybe even being some like chronic underlying infections. There have been some cool case reports that I've seen at different integrative meetings where patients are being tested for some of these molds and these toxins and like all just sort of peeling back the layers. There was one case, I think it was Dr. Andrew Heyman that presented, or potentially James Lavelle, I can't remember, but they had a patient that was near sort of a toxic waste area and also had some layered infection pieces. But as they pulled out the toxins and pulled out the infectious agents and different things, like the person's cognitive function like significantly improved and was actually like able to go back to like functioning on their own in the home, whereas they were like needing help like 24/7 before. So it was just amazing. So I think I say that to say, like, I'm not sure that that's going to be everybody's case, but there's so much that we still need to learn about all of this and so much research going into this space. I think in 20 years, we're going to just know so much more about the best ways to take care of these patients.
It's just a reminder that we all know what we're supposed to do. We're supposed mm-hmm. to eat healthy. We're supposed to move. Like, just keep doing that stuff and do it more often than not. And just be mindful of all of that, because it's so many things are involved in it. It's not just going to be our memory and our mental function in our future years, which, I, like Katie said, that's one of everyone's biggest fears, is to lose that function. And but it's also your physical functions, your heart, your like cancer risk, your everything is just involved in just making all these small decisions. They all add up all day. So just trying to do the best we can.
Yes, that's a great reminder. I think sometimes it gets overwhelming with like, oh my goodness, I have to do everything. And then you also have to like take care of these children in front of you, or take care of aging parents, and, you know, all the people that rely on you in life. And you're like, okay, and here I am eating a hot dog or something like that. And you just have to give yourself grace in the process and try as best you can to incorporate a lot of these principles, for sure. Yeah. So awesome. Well, thanks, ladies, for joining me. I really appreciate it and look forward to our next discussion.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.